about the commencement of the election process. I will now proceed to call for nominations for the position of acting chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Transport. Are there any nominations? I recognize Honourable Olive.
I would nominate the Honourable Suka to be the acting chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Olive. Are there any more nominations?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm worried. I'm getting worried when I'm elected by my opposition. and the ANC agrees to that. That alliance is much more questionable. But nevertheless, thank you very much in placing confidence in me. I wish to welcome everybody to this very important meeting. Also hastily acknowledge and appreciate the presence of the Deputy Minister, Mamuchu Kunga. You are welcome. It's much appreciated seeing the executive member to be part of this meeting. members, we've got three items on the agenda. I'm like a business person, straight to the point. So that time is money. Three items, but I would like to adjust our agenda. We'll start with item three, followed by item two, and the last one will be item one. And I assume that everybody does have an agenda in front of him or her. I know that there are many role players from the department, from the state law advisors, colleagues from the AG's office, everybody else. I wish you to take off your jackets and relax a little bit, and you are welcome. Thank you very much. good morning, Dr. Krumpo. I'm sorry that we started just by a few seconds before you arrive, but you are welcome. Thank you. Without saying much, ladies and gentlemen, we'll start with number two, the bill. Whilst we're still fresh in our minds, and we'd like to start with the bill on the final deliberations, and you would want to adopt this bill, the Transport Laws and Related Matters Amendment Bill. We'll start with that one. We will be led by the department, am I right? Or the parliamentary legal advisor. And thereafter, I know that there are some sessions. There is an agreement, 99.9%, but surely we need just to test out a little item. Yes, so that we get through it. In other words, we'll be dealing with the C bill and the D bill. Can we be taken through? We've acknowledged everybody. We'll start with C and then go for D. Who's going to be the state law advisor? Oh, parliamentary. Okay, legal advisor. Thank you. Sorry for that. You are observed and recognized. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First Amendment. Transport Rules and Related Matters Amendment Bill, Bill 33 of 2012, Clause 3. On page 3 in line 8, to omit the first paragraph in inverted commas, in other words, we take out the word paragraph, and to substitute paragraphs. So we're simply replacing that word with an S, so that there's more than one paragraph that follows. On page 3, in line 15, to omit inverted commas and the word and then 3 on page 3 after line 15, to insert the following. And you will recall the reason for this insertion was that the report of the social impact study that was done on social economic impact on an area, as well as the traffic impact, that must be published. So the proposed wording, as was agreed by the committee last week, would be paragraph B, capital B, a notice of the publication of the report contemplated in paragraph B, capital A, is published in the Gazette indicating the availability of such a report, and then we continue in the main bill to the next section. So if we look then at B, city D, that is now the bill as it will look with that amendment inserted. If I can maybe just also explain to the members why we did not continue on the A list, we actually had to ask a little bit of procedural advice on this aspect, and we were advised from the bills office, the office that does editing of the bills, that because the committee has looked and adopted a B bill, it might be just a logical process to follow to a C list. Although it wasn't 100% certain, I don't think that there will be any problem. In the end, what we want is a document that we can put before the National Assembly for a second reading, and that is what the end product must be. So we proceeded with the C bill, the C list and the D bill, and simply when we do our report, the committee's report on the bill, that will just be explained to the National Assembly. It will be indicated that it was referred back and that the committee then considered further amendments. So if I can take you to the exact amendment in Bill D, it is on page 3. It is amendment of Section 27 of Act 7 of 1998, and it is Clause 3 of the bill. The aspect that is amended is in paragraph B of Clause 3, and you will see that it reads, by the insertion in subsection 4 of the following paragraph after paragraph B. So that is, there was the first amendment. We now have paragraphs, plural, rather than the singular, because we're inserting two sub-paragraphs. It starts then with paragraph B, capital A, the agency, in cooperation with the municipality contemplated in subsection 4, paragraph B, sub 2, and the province in which the proposed toll road is situated, has performed a socio-economic and traffic impact assessment pertaining to the proposed toll road, which must be submitted to the minister and made available to the province and every municipality contemplated in subsection 4, paragraph B. 6, capital B, B, capital B, a notice of the publication of the report contemplated in paragraph B, capital A, is published in the Gazette indicating the availability of such report. And then it continues to paragraph C. So that is the proposal. That's the only aspect that is different. I just have one comment on this aspect. I'm of the opinion that we need to add the word and, or rather in the C list, not delete the word and. And I will explain to you where that is. On page 3, line 15, the end of paragraph B, capital A, I'm of the opinion the word and should be included at the end of that paragraph, because what we are saying is that both paragraph B, capital A, and B, capital A, B, must happen. And therefore, the word and should be inserted. So that is just one aspect that I would like the committee to consider, and if the committee agrees, that is something that is just simply a slight drafting change that we will make before the matter goes to the National Assembly. One other aspect that came up last week, during last week's discussion, was the application of the National Credit Act. Now, I don't know if the committee would want me to first stop because it is two different issues. So we first deal with this, the amendment, and then continue with the National Credit Act.
Thank you for that clarity. I'm not sure whether members do have anything to say, because for logical process and the seamless in the inclusion of AND in line 15. Any comments, ladies and gentlemen? Because for me, it does not change the content and the substantive matters, but it's just for logical and seamless arrangement or processes.
I agree with the advisor. Not going to make a massive difference, but if anybody ever goes to court and starts suing somebody, it should probably be clear that both steps must be taken, and just makes it a little bit clearer and avoids perhaps expensive litigation later, so I would support her. Yeah.
Any second to that, or any opposing view from members? Are you all in agreement? We are influenced and take the advice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under anything next, I think, is the application of the National Credit Act. Members have been provided with an opinion from the State Law Advisor, who undertook to look into the concern whether the National Credit Act applies on behalf of the committee. Now, again, I mean, at a disadvantage, because I need to argue someone else's case and give due credit to that person, or due weight to that person's argument. So what I will do in an attempt to be as fair as possible to the State Law Advisor, I will simply take you through the State Law Advisor's opinion. The State Law Advisor simply starts off the opinion by indicating what she was requested to do, namely whether the National Credit Act is applicable to the collection of toll. She then starts with a discussion, looking at the purpose of the bill, namely that it is to provide more effectively for the collection of toll and to facilitate effective law enforcement in relation to toll roads. Now, she looks then at the definition of a toll, and it's not defined in the Sunroll Act on page 2 of her opinion at the top. It is not defined in the Sunroll Act. But she refers us to Collins English Dictionary, the third edition, where toll is defined as an amount of money levied, especially for the use of certain roads, bridges, etc., to cover the costs of maintenance. And I think that definition is very important. Then she continues to say, looking at what this bill, where this bill applies, and she reaches the conclusion that in fact this is what it is for. She then looks at what Sunroll's side was, namely that it does not create any issues related to the National Credit Act. It is a prepaid system. It's not to extend credit to road users. She then continues and looks at the National Credit Act itself, where, and she looks at Section 4, starting with Section 4, saying that the National Credit Act is applicable to every credit agreement between parties dealing at arm's length and made within the Republic, and it is subject to Sections 5 and 6. Now, she gives a whole section there, and I'm not going to read it, but it simply indicates to us what, in fact, constitutes a credit agreement. So we have things like credit facilities, credit guarantees, a policy of insurance under certain circumstances, pawn transactions, and so on. And she comes to the conclusion that indeed the toll agreement is, the toll that's being levied is not an agreement and therefore not a credit agreement. Then she, however, continues to look at incidental credit agreement. Now, incidental credit agreement, there I think I would like to read to you, because this is the relevant portion of her opinion, and this is on the last page of her opinion at the top. Incidental credit agreement means an agreement, irrespective of its form, in terms of which an account was tendered for goods or services that have been provided to the consumer, or goods or services that are to be provided to a consumer over a period of line. A, a fee charged for interest became payable when payment of an amount charged in terms of that account was not made on or before a determined period or date. What we're talking about there is you will have a clothing account, for instance. Clothing account says if you pay the full amount at the end of this month, there's no additional cost. In fact, you're getting it at the price on the ticket that you have bought. But if you don't pay the full amount this month, next month, if you pay half, you will pay an extra 5% on that price to cover for our cost of giving you credit. So that is what the first paragraph talks about. The second paragraph B, two prices were quoted for settlement of the account, the lower price being applicable if the account is paid on or before a determined date, and the higher price being applicable due to the account not having been paid at that date. Here, I think we can think more of home appliances, where you would go to a big store that sells home appliances, and there will be two prices, cash price and a credit price. And that is what we're talking about here. She then looks at this section 5, and she says, it provides for limited application of the National Credit Act to incidental credit agreement, and she just explains when the incidental agreement kicks in. Her conclusion is that Section 5 of the National Credit Act is indeed applicable to the recovery of outstanding toll money. I've discussed this opinion with Sandra, and they have referred me to an opinion that they obtained from senior counsel. I do not think the committee members have access to that opinion, but it can be made available. What senior counsel did was he did exactly the same exercise, looking at the National Credit Act, looking at specifically incidental credit agreements. His argument is that it is not an incidental credit agreement. I think we at this point in time have consensus it is not a credit agreement. It might be an incidental credit agreement. So that is what we then need to focus on. And counsel looks at, first of all, he says the relationship between the toll user and Sunroll is not an agreement. He says the arrangement derives from the Sunroll Act and the regulations promulgated thereunder and is imposed on the consumer regardless of his or her agreement thereto. In fact, I think it was wrong to say consumer. I think should have said the user of the road, regardless of his or her agreement thereto. And he refers us to case law, where a court looked at the imposition of levies by a sectional title scheme. And the court said, but that is not an agreement. The person living or buying into a sectional title scheme has no option. There's no agreement that can be negotiated. The levies are payable by virtue of an obligation imposed by the provisions of the Sectional Title Act and the regulations promulgated in terms thereof. So, exactly what we are dealing with. It is something that is imposed in terms of legislation. Council then also gives a few other aspects, saying that if you look at the purpose of the National Credit Act, that is not applicable to the Sunroll situation. Because the Credit Act, where you have your lower cash price, that is not what Sunroll is doing. The full amount that is payable in the end is, in fact, the cost that should be paid. It is simply in order to have some enticement for immediate payment that the amount is lowered. Another argument made by counsel is that if you look at the National Credit Act and you apply that to Sunroll on incidental agreement, it just does not make sense. There are a number of issues that just do not gel. He then indicates, and this is where I went out, because it was a bit not nice to hear this, but unfortunately we have case law that says this, namely that the National Credit Act is notorious for its lack of clarity. And he quotes a number of cases, and I think members can read the opinion. It's uncomfortable to say these things out loud. Things like scarcely muffle a cry of exasperation if you have to interpret that. I would not continue, but his argument is that if there is doubt whether this act is in fact applicable, then it would be best to exclude it in legislation. So we have the two views. The first view of the State Law Advisor, that we are looking at an incidental credit agreement, and the view of counsel, which says no, because it's not an agreement to start off with. And then if we are uncertain about it, that actually just simply speaks towards changing it. Now, having looked at both of these opinions, I think, and that's why I said the definition of toll for me is a very important thing to start with. Because it's clear from that definition, a levy, an amount of money levied, especially for the use of certain roads, bridges, etc., to cover the cost of maintenance. And if we then look at Section 5 of the National Credit Act, it starts with means and agreement. So I think, first of all, that is out, because we're not talking about an agreement. Then it goes on, irrespective of its form, in terms of which an account was tendered for goods and services. We don't have goods and services here. It is a road that is available and for use. And what we are now saying is, in order for the government to have income towards maintenance of that road, there will be a levy incurred. So I do not think that that incidental agreement is applicable here, and then that means that the National Credit Act is not applicable. But something else, and there I agree with counsel, and although, like I say, it hurts to say it is not a nice act to interpret, I agree with the inclusion in the bill that we actually exclude specifically the National Credit Act. And even if a very strong argument could be made that the Credit Act is applicable, which I'm of the opinion it's not, but then lawyers, you have so many lawyers and you have 10 more opinions. But if that argument is made up, and if someone is convinced of that argument, then I would say that all the more it is necessary to exclude it in this bill, because we have a hierarchy of legislation. Supreme is our constitution. No law can exclude it. In fact, it is so supreme that if a law is against it, the Constitutional Court can declare that law invalid. That is how strong that is. Then we have laws that are promulgated because of a constitutional obligation. So we look at access to information, administrative justice, labor. Those laws we call overarching legislation. And whatever you legislate under them, if it goes against, if it's in conflict, they trump. The National Credit Act is not one of those. It is not an overarching piece of legislation. In fact, in the Act itself, in Section 172, it specifically provides for conflict with other legislation. And it says if there's a conflict between the provision of this Act, it's a very confusing section, so I'd rather explain it to you. There's a schedule included in the National Credit Act. And it says that if you look at that schedule, and there's a conflict between this Act, the National Credit Act, and the specific other Act, then the table will tell you which Act trumps. And the one that is very much applicable is the Public Finance Management Act. And it says that the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act will trump the National Credit Act. Now, a problem that SunCrop has is that the PFMA does not allow it to be a credit provider. So if we do not exclude the National Credit Act, SANA will be in a bit of a problem in that the PFMA will trump and they will have to comply with that and will thus be unable to comply with the National Credit Act. And accordingly, in order for us to avoid a tension in our legislation or a possible conflict, I would advise that the National Credit Act specifically be excluded. Thank you.
What the motivation at the end of the day for an exclusion? It's not an overarching bill. Secondly, the PFMA kicks in because PFMA cuts across all, especially for purposes of accountability and so on, both financial and material wise. It's quite an involved argument, this one. special, and also our other person is not feeling very comfortable in explaining this act, but nevertheless, she did take us into cases. I think also she gives credit to the person whom she is representing in explaining the bill. I think we've looked at that. Otherwise, without saying much, and also, you see, when you say there are no goods and services in the bill, well, it means it's a serious matter, because normally, where goods and services are, it should be, there's an element also of accountability in that sense, especially on the spending of it. That's my narrow understanding. I'm not a legal person, but I was trying to catch up with what she says. In other words, road users, in fact, also the technology, where you connected to the technology. So I'm saying we've noted also those matters. I'm not sure, ladies and gentlemen, there it is. What motivation? At one, we did at the end of the day. I'm in your hands. I've noted to Mr. Ollis, Omar Ollis, and all member there. Thank you. Just before, I also want to say there's an element of the PRC. Chairperson has arrived, and I will recuse myself so that she takes her rightful place. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair, for your arrival. I'm relieved.
Thank you very much. We will proceed. Honorable Ollis has been acknowledged. I'll give you the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you for the lengthy legal explanation. We've been through this, I'm sure you remember, several times before, and it came up again last week. I think when we look at what the purpose of the National Credit Act is, it's to protect consumers, and it's to protect them from getting themselves in debt that they don't fully understand, or where there's runaway debt and so on. So really for us, the question is, are the consumers sufficiently protected by this bill? Do they understand what they're getting themselves into and so on? And I made it clear that there was a key reason why I was concerned about the non-applicability of the National protect the consumer. And if we can ensure that the consumer is fully aware of the cost that they're incurring when they drive on the toll roads, then I think we've done what we can to put the motorist, if you like, or the consumer in a full understanding of what they're going to have to pay. If we can agree to that, then I'm okay, because really then the consumer is driving on the road in full knowledge that they're going to pay extra if they don't have an e-tag, for example, or if they don't comply. And that's, I think, the purpose of the credit regulatory system, that we protect the consumer, and that's my thing. So if Sandon will just nod and we can put it in the minutes again today, then I will undertake to drop the issue of the National Credit Act, because I think that the consumer is then covered, and I accept the explanation from the legal team that, in fact, it would be legally impossible to implement. I'm just imagining 17,000 consumers that now have to sign an agreement with Sanrail in a documentary form. It would make it completely impossible to administer. We remain opposed to the funding model, but I'm not going to be ridiculous about the National Credit Act. Thank you. Chair, yes, from Sanrail's side, we've looked into that and we've done the investigation. It's been addressed. Lines are there and it's already in place to be implemented to display both the tariffs before the toll gantry and at all the other places the higher standard tariff.
Thank you. Honourable Alvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologise for being a little bit late. The central problem with regard to the National Credit Act's applicability is the protection of the user, consumer, or whatever you want to call the person driving on the road. Goods are delivered. A new road is delivered. Goods, it's simple goods. It complies with the Credit Act. So if you say the Credit Act is not going to be applicable, what recourse are you giving the road user? There's no toll regulator in this country. The minister has talked about implementing a toll regulator. When I asked him in a parliamentary question whether he's still going to do it, he said, well, yes, to a degree, they're going to implement a super transport regulator that will oversee all tariffs related to transport, public transport in South Africa and tolling and so forth. But we don't know when that is going to happen. That can take ages. In the meantime, we have a Credit Act that's there to protect the consumer, but you say no. We won't give you those rights. We're taking those rights away from you because Sunrail is holy. They can be ring-fenced against these remedies provided by the public. So my question then is, what will government and Sunrail put in place to provide remedies for consumers or road users when they are not happy? As Honourable Ollis has indicated, people who drive on those roads can be left with huge bills in the end of the day, especially when they don't know the rules of tolling and how it works and so forth. And we have many people in this country who are poor, who do not have access to all the information necessarily by virtue of the internet and so forth. How are we going to protect those people? Who are they going to run to? They can't run to the credit regulator anymore. They could have run to the Consumer Commission, but there's rules there that also exclude it if it's a credit agreement. So I'm leaving that question to the committee, and especially to Sunrail and government. Then further, with regards to the opinion on the exclusion of the Credit Act, I would just like to state, with regards to the PFMA that says that Sunrail is not allowed to be a credit provider, the Credit Act says that you must register to be a credit provider in terms of the Act. All Sunrail has to do is not to register, and then they will not be deemed to be a credit provider. Why exclude the Credit Act as a whole? I agree that the agreement that comes into being is an incidental agreement in terms of Section 5 of the National Credit Act. And just a further argument that was put forward by the law advisors, that a levy is imposed. So what you have here is a public relation. relationship where you have a subordinate member of public that goes into not an agreement but is forced to make a payment no matter what. You have no choice in that. If that is the case, then you have to seriously consider retagging this bill, because then you're talking about a money bill if that relationship is different. If it's not different, then there is a relationship between SANRAL and the public where the public enters into an agreement with SANRAL to use the roads, and therefore the NCA, National Credit Act, should be applicable. And I think we need to revisit these issues very comprehensively. I don't quite agree with the conclusions that was made today. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we have debated this issue sufficiently, and we have also given the Freedom Fund Plus to advance its proposals and arguments. We've had the Freedom Fund Plus, but at the end of the day, the decision that will be taken by this portfolio committee, having listened to everybody. And I don't think that we are going to spend any more time discussing this issue. We have had we've given enough time to this. We have had all the arguments. I just want to make a ruling that we are done now with this argument. We are going to proceed as we have planned to look at the amendment that we accepted, and then move forward and take a decision on the bill. We have spent enough time, and I also want to say that laws are made to create a conducive environment to make the situation easy for people. And what has been advanced by the both departments, SANRAL and the legal advisors, is also aimed at making the administration of as easy as possible without compromising the road users. And there has been an undertaking that relates to informing the road users. So the argument then that relates to the National Credit Regulator and the response also of the Minister in terms of what he was going to put in place as a regulator and the time frame that it would take. Those are perceptions. We should now look at how we have taken care of the road users in terms of them getting information, and SANRAL has committed on how they would take care of that. The department has committed on how they would take care of that. And we have also agreed, Honorable Ollis has proposed that that should be on our minutes, and it is we had discussed this bill in the past, and then we came back to accommodate the Freedom Fund Act, and most of the submissions were related to Clause 3, which is on page 3 of the bill, and we were assisted by the legal team to do a draft. I would now, Advocate Masombo, is he here? Okay. I would now ask Advocate Masombo to read what has been now put on as an amendment.
Thanks, Jefferson. On page 3 of the bill, outside is written B, is B30D 2012, page 3 of the said bill. The final proposed amendment is on section, on clause 3, that is section 27 of the Sunrail Act. It says, like the readers follow, section 27 of the South African National Road Agency Limited and National Roads Act 1998 is hereby amended. A, by the addition in subsection 3B of the following subparagraphs. 5, the means by which the passage of a vehicle beneath or through a toll plaza is identified and the liability to pay toll is recorded. And the means of payment, including prepayment of toll liability. Paragraph B, by the insertion of subsection 4 of the following paragraphs after paragraph B. B capital A, the agency in cooperation with the municipality contemplated in subsection 4B, paragraph 2, and the province in which the proposed toll road is situated has performed a socio-economic and traffic impact assessment pertaining to the proposed toll road, which must be submitted to the minister and made available to the province and every municipality contemplated in subsection 4B. Then we propose that N should be inserted in there to join paragraph B capital A with C. And C says, with paragraph B capital B, and it reads as follows: a notice of the publication of the report contemplated in paragraph BA is published in the Gazette indicating the availability of such a report. That is the proposed amendment.
Members satisfied with that amendment. Okay, before that, I'll give the legal advice.
Thank you, Manager, and I do apologize. In respect of the addition of and, before Chairperson joined us, I explained that I proposed that an and be added. Unfortunately, State Law Advisor is not here so that I could debate with her why the and should not be added. And I've tried to make sense of it, and I think I now understand why she took the and out. So if I may please remove my proposal so that the C list and the D bill as printed remains as it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, comments now from the members of the Purple Committee.
If you look at section
second last paragraph of any, well, this would be a clause in the bill and sections in the Principal Act. So the reason for the and at the end of paragraph B is because in clause 3 it is the second last paragraph. So that is why we have an and at the end of 6 capital B. What I think I understand from the state law advisor is because we are inserting paragraphs into section 27 of the Principal Act, subsection 4, paragraph B, capital A, is not going to be the second last paragraph. That section, in fact, that subsection 4, in fact, goes up to D. So the and there should be in paragraph C. And that is why the state law advisor said, no, not in B capital A, or within B capital B even. It comes in the Principal Act in paragraph C. So that's where the and should be in section 27, subsection 4. But if we look at clause 3, there's different rules that apply. So it's very technical, but it is simply a drafting style principle.
So in other words, it doesn't interfere with the object of the bill and the content of the bill. It's just a style. Honorable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may ask if the gentleman who read the insertion, could just read it again. I think I'm happy. I just want to hear it again to be sure, please. Thank you.
Advocate Masobo, I can do it again.
It reads as follows. B capital A, the agency in cooperation with the municipality contemplated in subsection 4B, paragraph 2, and the province in which the proposed toll road is situated, has performed a socio-economic and traffic impact assessment pertaining to the proposed toll road, which must be submitted to the minister and made available to the province and every municipality contemplated in subsection 4B. B capital B, a notice of the publication of the report contemplated in paragraph BA is published in the Gazette indicating the availability of such a report. And
thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it's a good drafting. Thank you.
Well, not just as in, I think, you know, because the COVID has agreed initially, so we want also to say we withdraw and subscribe to the new version. Thank you, Chairperson.
now that we have deliberated and also we have run through all the clauses and the bills, may I have now a proposal for the approval of the bill as well as a seconder for the approval of the bill? Honorable. We are asking for a member that is proposing that we approve the bill.
Yes, Chief. Thank you very much. contract for DG Mahlalela. His contract therefore came to an end on the 24th of this month, and the minister therefore decided to appoint an acting DG until such time that the position is filled. And therefore I am to present to the portfolio committee the acting DG of the Department of Transport by the name of Dr. Maria Dudoit, sitting next to me, and is going to act until such time that we then appoint a new DG. I must say that the process is continuing. We already have conducted interviews, and as you know, that the DGs are appointed by cabinet. We therefore are going to take the names that are possible to be appointed to cabinet, and after that we will then appoint a DG for the department. We therefore request that the portfolio committee accept her and support her. She's only acting at the DG, and maybe take the opportunity to inform the portfolio committee that I woke up from my house at Pelican Park. It's a four-room house, not the 10.6 million house. And that I had nothing to do with it, because the renovation started in May. I was only appointed in June. I had nothing to do with the procurement processes. I know nothing about it. But I think I must inform the portfolio committee so that you know about it, because it was in the mid. That I'll be occupying a house that is renovated at a cost of 10.6 million. Whether it's 10.6 million or it's 2.6 million, I really don't know, because I was just shown a house. I've not occupied the house. I'm still staying in my four-room house in Pelican Park. And happy to say that to the portfolio committee. No, thank you very much. Thank you very much from the Deputy Minister for coming to the portfolio committee to introduce an acting DG. We know Dr. Toy. She's been with the department for quite some time, and I think she also understands how we operate. We have given her support on her previous work, particularly when she was dealing with her entity. It was a huge challenge, and we will be supported. We are also happy to Minister that in introducing Dr. Detroit, you are also giving us a report that the post has been already advertised and interviews have been conducted. That gives us an assurance that the acting DG will not be acting until Duncan comes home, which has been the signal in the department, in our entity, that we will be having people that are in acting positions, creating uncertainty in them as well as their families, as well as in the decisions that they need to take. It's difficult to take any concrete decisions and speak up your mind if you are in an acting position. We want to thank you very much for that. And also we want to thank you for coming to the portfolio committee.
it is within the powers of Parliament to begin with the process of addressing the wrongs that are happening in the Public Works Department in terms of the policies and the law. But it is not going to help us to actually not deal with the real problem, but instead leave the real problem and focus on individuals when we know that it is the system that is wrong. The manner in which Public Works does its business is what is wrong. But most unfortunately, our failure in Parliament to deal with that has a very negative impact on the image and the reputation of ministers and deputy ministers and their families, because when something is written about you, you can't go around and explain to everyone. But we all know that ministers and deputy ministers have no role to play at all in deciding what renovations need to be done by Public Works, what houses they are allocated. You don't even choose the house that you are moving in. You are not given any opportunity to choose your furniture, nothing. But instead of writing about the real problem, people choose to write about individuals. And I think that a parliament should begin to address the root problem. Because the problem is not the minister, the problem is Public Works, and the problem that gives public works space to operate in the manner they are operating is actually the policies of Parliament. It's Parliament that has to change the manner in which Public Works does its business. So, thank you. I'm sorry that your name is in the media of something that you really have. We would want to take this opportunity to welcome the Office of the Auditor General and say that we appreciate this and we are actually looking forward to this, because before you even went to do this work and came to us, we on our own were having our own questions that are related to the over-reliance of the Department of Transport on consultants. And we had identified that as a problem, not as a problem that does not only affect the National Department of Transport. It's a problem that runs down to the provincial department as well as the local government level. We undertook an oversight visit to three provinces. In one province, and we were following up on this Hambasonke program, a program that was given funding to deal with road maintenance and address the issue of potholes, because that problem is biting a lot in terms of the road accident fund and what the government of this country then in terms of financial resources as a result of lack of road maintenance. When we arrived in Northwest, we were presented with a report that we felt that it was very negative. to say that there are 110 consultants, not in the entire government structure, in other words, but 110 consultants servicing the Department of Transport. Not national, one province. When one looks at the structure of the Department of Transport in KwaZulu-Natal, the organogram, it was a surprise for me to realize that a consultant formed part of the government organogram. There is HOD, and below the HOD, consultant. I was shocked. That then also relates to what we have been observing when we were undertaking those oversight. We came across a situation where cement was used to repair the potholes, which then indicates a situation of no value for money. Money was spent, and if one was just going to focus on whether the budget, if you just look at expenditure, you would say, yes, money was spent. And if you look at where this money was spent, you would find that money was spent on what it was supposed to do, to repair the potholes and maintain the road. But if you don't go deeper to look at the value for money, you would then think that the situation is normal, it is good. You only get into the crux of the problem if you then go down and look at the outcome, what problem was being addressed, and has that problem been addressed to the satisfaction of the road user? And in our view, what we saw indicated that it was not. So we are happy, and we would want to engage properly with the report. Thank you very much.
Members, Honourable Deputy Minister, Departmental Representatives, Acting DG, honoured guests. Firstly, I must say it's a pleasure on behalf of the Auditor General of South Africa to accept this invitation from the Portfolio Committee to present to you the results of our recently tabled report.
And I'll talk a little bit now about why we think we say that's the case. We truly feel that it is not about the money or the value or the quantum of the money that we give to consultants, but it's really about the value that we derive from them, Chair, and I'll echo your comments from earlier, that if we spend a rand, are we getting the right value for money from that rand? We've also, Chair, conducted this audit because we have conducted similar exercises in the past, in 2002 and 1996, and part of the purpose of this audit really was to follow up on some of the progress that's been made in departments in respect of those previous audits. Before I get into some of the detail, Chairperson, I'd like to maybe just take some time to elaborate on this thing called a performance audit and why it differs from other audits. You'll see the diagram on the side there. We have categorized it in two parts. You have performance auditing on the left-hand side, and the right-hand side you have something called regularity auditing, which the members must be very familiar with. Regularity auditing is the financial audit, if you may. It focuses on the financial statements, the financial management, whether the accounts are true and fair, and whether there has been compliance with various financial management prescripts and laws and regulations. And that's the audit that's done annually and reported. Chair, I'll echo what you said earlier, which was, that type of audit on the right-hand side focuses very much on the debits and credits, the money. And often, I'll echo what you said, despite the books balancing, all may not be well. And that is where performance auditing comes in. Performance audit is a specialized type of audit which focuses on what we call value for money. And we do that by looking at what we call the three E's. Now, these three E's are economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. And these three terms are referred to in the Constitution in Section 195 that talks about promoting the E's in government. And so hence, this is an area which each and every one of us really needs to pay a lot of attention to. So what are these three E's? Well, the three E's are economy. And economy means basically doing something at the best price, the best quality, the best time, making sure that you get the best value from the resources that you are using, doing it with minimal waste and minimal cost. Efficiency. Efficiency talks about the relationship between the input and the output. How much of input are you putting in versus the output that you're getting out? Is this an optimal relationship? Are you putting in too much to get too little out? Or is that relationship optimal? Effectiveness then talks to, are we achieving the objectives that we set out to achieve? If we use a consultant for a certain purpose, are we achieving that purpose through the use of that consultant? So when you take these three E's together, you are able to get to some measure of value for money in terms of we've seen a need, we've spent the money, are we getting what we spent the money for? Chairperson, on the next page of the presentation, I'm just going to share a little bit about the scope before we delve into some of the findings. This slide here is just a breakdown of the total spend of consultants, that 102 billion I talked about. And you'll see that it is split between national and provincial, the national bit being the blue bit and the provincial being the green bit. The national departments, which is the subject matter of the report that we tabled, accounts to almost 33% of the total, roughly 33.5 billion, whereas the provincial entities account for 67% of the total, and roughly 68.5 billion. Chair, honorable members, the areas in green, similar audits to what we've conducted for the national departments, we've conducted for the provincial ones as well, and these reports are going to be tabled in due course. But the subject matter, as you'll see for this year, is on for this report is on the blue bit, and you'll see from the 2008-09 to 2009-10 to planning an appointment, three issues really recurred. The one is that we often found that comprehensive need assessment was not done. And this is really important because if you don't identify your needs up front, if you don't know what you want, you'll get into trouble later on in the form of extensions, in the form of deliverables not meeting their objectives, in the form of the reliance that you talked about on consultants. We found instances where competitive procurement processes were not followed. So everything from the time in which a bid was presented to the number of bidders, etc., there were instances of that. And expectations on milestones, timelines, and costs not clearly specified. So again, this talks to planning and the robustness of planning. If you get your planning right up front, you'll find that many of the other little circles that we talked about earlier will sort themselves out. So if you are able to plan properly, chances are your extensions may actually be reduced because you have more robust thinking that's gone into it at the beginning of the period. The second area that we looked at was internal capacity, as I said, and two issues really recurred for us across all the departments. The first was that consultants who were appointed with permanent capacity should have been created. So the use of a consultant in a position where it would have been better served by having somebody internal for that particular role, and your example is noted on the provincial government having that situation. We also noted instances where consultants were appointed due to a lack of internal staff capacity. On the training and transfer of skills, obviously, this is one which is very important, and it goes back to, you know, if we don't have the skills as government, and we have to seek these skills outside in these service providers, are they transferring those skills to the people that we have employed as a state? Is there effective transfer? And indeed, many of the contracts we looked at have this provision, and the private sector have all put it into their proposals that they will do this. But for various reasons, as we've shown in the report, this does not happen. Performance management and monitoring, this is equally important in the use of an external service provider, where effective oversight and internal controls were not executed, especially before handing the money over. And one needs to offer, you know, just think about your own homes, for example, if where you are living. If somebody's doing work for you, would you pay them before they finish their work and leave? You know, and that's a similar principle to say, do you value for the money you pay, you need to get? Lack of proper project management and monitoring. So again, you know, would you leave somebody just to do their own thing without checking on them and making sure that they're doing the right thing, that they're delivering what they said they're going to deliver in the right time, the right place, the right quality, etc. And then cost overruns not being monitored and approved is a recurring finding as well. Extension of contracts is another area where we noted very often that contracts were extended, and many of the reasons for this we can draw back to a lack of project management and monitoring and planning, obviously. So if you don't plan up front properly, you don't monitor, and you don't manage the project, chances are that it's going to extend at some point in time. And then share the last area we found, which recurred throughout all the departments we audited, was around once a project is done, to learn from it and to use those lessons in the future. And that sums up the key challenges across departments. Chairperson, honorable members, with regards to the Department of Transport, this slide just shares with you some of the specifics around the scope again. From the 2008-09 to 2010-11 years, approximately 1.86 billion rand was spent on consultants. The number of projects that we audited as an office out of that 1.86 billion was 16. So we selected 16 contracts. And the value of the contracts we audited was about 1.884 billion. You'll see there's a little asterisk next to our figure because the amount audited exceeds the value on the top. And that's not a misprint. It's just that some of the contracts that we looked at were multi-year. And so a lot of them spread over a greater time period than our audit vacancy rate in the department was 2009 to 2010 years was 22.25%. I just also want to draw to the attention of the committee that the graph below provides a breakdown of the consultants in respect of three categories, really. Now, I said earlier that we use the term consultants in our report quite broadly. For us, it's any person who's provided an external service to a department. But in terms of the prescripts, really it boils down to three technical definitions of what a consultant can be, and that is a contractor, a consultant, as it were, or an agency and a support or outsourced service provider. And we've used the terms interchangeably in the report and used the broad brush to call them all consultants. The graph also shows the breakdown between the technical descriptions of consultants and contractors used by the department. Chairperson, honorable members, on page 10 of the presentation we put forward is a table. And this table we provided in response to requests from the chairpersons, amongst others, for some of the detail behind what appears in the report that was tabled in Parliament. The way to interpret this table, each row relates to a specific contract in the report, in the detailed report, and the names of the specific consultants involved in that contract have been provided under each row, the best available value of the contract that we have at our disposal, as well as the period of the contract in which that service was procured or provided. We've also attempted then to classify, based on those three categories I talked about, whether that outsourced service provider or whether that service provider was a consultant, a contractor, or an agency and outsourced service provider in terms of the prescripts. The table then goes on to areas where deficiencies were identified during the audit. And if you recall those six blocks, or six round circles, which talk about the life cycle of managing a consultant, whenever you see a tick appear in those columns, it means that a deficiency was identified in that contract with respect to that issue. The last three columns of the table talk about which E was affected. Now, remember I talked earlier about the three E's, which are economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. So where you see a tick, it means that one or more of those principles was violated or affected during the execution of this contract. Chairperson, that table extends to page 11 and covers the breadth of the 16 contracts that were taken as a sample during our audit. I'm now just going to hand over to Jacques Boshoff, who's sitting on my right-hand side here. Jacques is the senior manager who is responsible for some of the detailed audit work, to take us through some of the details around these contracts and some of our key recommendations as they refer to each of these contracts. Jacques, may you just take us to page 12 and thereafter.
Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you, Chair and honorable members. On this slide, one will see all the variations that we found on these contracts. So if you go back one slide, you will see there's a total of 8 underneath the table for extension of contracts. And what we did is we just analyzed that before we provide more detail. Now, if one looks at that table, and we included there the original amount of the contract and what a variation amount was, and then also we had an indication whether or not there was compliance with the procurement policy. Now, in most of those contracts, you will see there that in 6 of the 8, there were a compliance indeed with the procurement policy. However, it points to a bigger problem if one goes back one slide where we, like my colleague said, why was it necessary for variations? And in many instances, it light green, a light pink, and a purple color, where we've shaded each of the findings to indicate from us to the portfolio committee what action is necessary based on that findings. So the green ones, we say we require intense scrutiny of the strategic plans and accountability reports. The light pink, we say these actions or these findings in terms of that should be monitored quarterly. And then the purple, we say there must be a follow-up on the corrective actions against the action plans proposed by the department. So now, if we go back to the development of the INATAs, the main findings there was firstly that there was no transfer management plan to the department on the INATAs and related services after 5 years in May 2007 when the contract ended. Secondly, after the contract ended, a total of 936.2 million was paid for additional services that did not form part of the original contract. And lastly, the extension of contract that took place in 2010 was not subjected to a competitive procurement process. If we go to the next contract, the tax recapitalization project, there we say, the main findings there were the project was not properly planned by the department, which resulted in an increased budget of 2.1 million to get this project done. Secondly, the scrap metal proceeds for the scrap taxes could not be accounted for at the time of the audit. And thirdly, at the time of audit, the consultant's progress reports were lacking. We were not able to get that. Then if we move to the third contract, about the maritime pollution prevention response and services, my finding there was that because of poor planning by the department, it resulted in 3 extensions of the contract over a period of 21 months, which cost the department 98 million rand. Go to the next slide. Fourth project was an events management project, where departmental staff changed the project scope without approval, which resulted in an additional cost to the department of 4.3 million rand. Next project is the management of October Transport Month, where we say the appointment was made only 5 days before the start of the project. And then secondly, the consultant had access to information prior to the bid invitation, and only 11 days was granted for tenders to submit proposals for this project. And the consultant was notified of appointment 3 days before the evaluation process was finalized. And the next project is the formulation of the National Airports Development Plan, where we say that the appointment was made for consultants because the department lacked adequate staff to compile this plan and available personnel did not have the skill and time to develop this plan. At the time of audit as well, the plan has not yet been approved by Cabinet for implementation. The plan has been finished, but it didn't go through all the stakeholder consultations yet. And then lastly, where we look at the National Transport Master Plan, there we say that insufficient positions on the staff establishment of transport for the implementation, monitoring, and editing of this plan, which resulted in the reliance on the use of consultants. I'll now give over to my colleague again to take you through the key recommendations that we proposed in our report.
Thank you, Jacques. Chairperson, honourable members, the detail of these contracts is contained in the report that was tabled in Parliament in the relevant Department of Transport section on page 81. And so there's nothing really new in these slides apart from the names of the consultants that are now mapped to each and every one of the reported entities. So what are we saying, honourable members, chairperson, is that we have made a number of recommendations in our report on how we can remedy this situation. And let me, before I start talking about them, reiterate that this was not an investigation. This is a performance audit, which is focused on the process, is focused on the 3 E's, and whether we get value for money for the way in which we use these consultants. Again, let me reiterate that we are certainly not recommending that we terminate the relationship with consultants. Indeed, we echo the fact that it's a national relationship of national importance, which is important for our country and important for us in terms of how we deliver services to our citizens. There are, of course, transport, where many of these scarce skills reside in the private sector, necessitates us to think very strategically about how we will be dipping into that pool of knowledge, how we will be using them, and what value we will be extracting from that knowledge base. We also recommend on the block to the right of that compliance with the existing legal frameworks, laws, regulations, and policies. So there are many prescripts that already deal with this matter that have been issued by various coordinating ministries and organizations, and we recommend that adherence and compliance to these prescripts be enforced. The third recommendation is that we indicate maximum contract value in number of hours. So obviously giving a consultant a contract which is open-ended is not a very smart thing to do from our side. We must establish limits on the contracts in terms of number of hours as well as the value of those contracts and deal with extensions properly then through variation orders that we can properly think through and properly consider as part of the planning process. Managing and monitoring performance, very important. Consultants should not be left to their own devices. The service provider client relationship, the client service provider relationship must be maintained in order to ensure that there is accountability for the services that are being delivered by these consultants. Even if they are being used on a secondment basis, they must still be held accountable for the services and the delivery of those services to the department. Training and transfer skills is very important as well. It's important that as we dip into this pool of knowledge that resides in the private sector, that we extract the value that we require, that proper training and transfer skills, expertise and knowledge happens. But this will only happen if we are vigilant in making sure that it is happening, that we manage it properly. We make sure that if we have included a provision in a contract to say, consultant, you will transfer knowledge to three or four members of our department, we need to have the bodies in the seat firstly for that consultant to be able to transfer the knowledge to somebody. Secondly, the process in which that knowledge is transferred needs to be managed and monitored to make sure that it happens in an effective way. Extending contracts for only valid reasons, this is a recommendation we feel that really needs a bit more robust accountability around. Very often, as we've echoed earlier, the extension of contracts can be traced back to planning. So if we don't plan properly, if we don't know what we want, chances are that down the line we're going to be faced with an extension. Again, if you don't monitor the consultant, if you don't monitor the output, the deliverable, to make sure that that which was agreed to in the contract is being delivered, one often will find that you get to the end of the period not having achieved what you set out to achieve, and hence you will extend the contract. Some of the other recommendations, if I move back to the left side of that diagram, is around formal needs assessment being conducted. Again, I talked earlier about this, that before you enter into a relationship with a consultant, be clear as to what exactly you need. What are your needs? What are your requirements? By when? How much? What exactly are they going to deliver? Who's going to receive it? What are we going to do with it when we get it? What hole is this going to plug? And let us be sure about that before we enter into any form of agreement with a service provider. Creating sufficient internal capacity on two levels. Firstly, creating the capacity for that which we normally outsource because we don't have capacity. And so often you find that the reason why we've gone out to a service provider is because we don't have somebody to do it ourselves. And that's very dangerous because it can become this reinforcing loop that you get into. You get a consultant because you don't have anybody, and then you don't get somebody because you have a consultant. So it's a very difficult situation to get out of. So creating capacity is very important, and obviously take into consideration the fact that we do have an acknowledged skills crisis in the country. It's very important that we use consultants in the right way. Investigating possible fruitless and wasteful expenditure, as always, as I must point out, that this audit was 2008-2009, right until 2011. This is history. We've spent the money, we've done all of this. How do we prevent this from happening again? And this is, must be the focus, I think, of the portfolio and in all our minds going forward, to say that while it is history, and yes, we'll get to the whole bottom of it, we'll hold people accountable for history, we must keep our eye on the future and make sure that this doesn't happen again, that we plug the gaps in terms of the use of consultants, and we think some of the recommendations we put forward today will help us achieve that. Honourable members, chairperson, on the next page, we've included a model. And it's a model that we call the combined assurance model. It's not something that the AG itself has come up with. Indeed, this is a model that's used by many organizations, both in the public sector and the private sector, and globally as well. And the combined assurance model, Jacques, if I may just ask you to proceed to... Yeah. The combined assurance model talks about risk. In any organization, risk is there. Risk is inherent in running the public sector. And you have risk takers who take risk because that is important in achieving benefits, in achieving what they need to achieve. And that those risk takers are the management, which is represented by the left-hand side of the block. They represent what we call the first level of assurance that risk is being adequately addressed. And there we talk about senior management themselves, the accounting officers, various authorities, as well as the executive authority, exercising extensive assurance to make sure that the risks inherent in, for example, using consultants are adequately addressed. So the first level of assurance comes from those who are using consultants themselves. And we have outlined on the slide down the bottom what we think that that assurance role should be. Senior management, for example, should take immediate actions to address specific recommendations and adhere to various financial management and control systems. The accounting officers should hold account officials accountable for the use of resources and report annually on the use of consultants. The executive authority should monitor the use of consultants and enforce accountability and consequences. So we truly feel that the first level assurance starts at the department itself. The second level of assurance then that starts completing the picture is then the oversight assurance. And here is where we talk about the coordinating and monitoring institution, internal audit and the various audit committees, which have an important role to play in, again, giving extensive assurance around the use of consultants. The roles that we envisage, for example, for National Treasury and DPSA is to monitor the compliance with laws and regulations and enforce appropriate action. Internal audit for us are a vital piece of maintaining effective control of the use of consultants by following up on management's actions to address specific recommendations, as has been made in this report. But importantly, internal audit is in a position to conduct these performance audits themselves. They don't have to wait for the Office of the Auditor General to come along to perform an audit of the three E's. Internal audit is in a position to conduct these audits regularly and to provide feedback to management and to the committee and various providers in terms of assurance. The audit committee, of course, we feel should play an important role in monitoring the implementation of consultants and on corrective action made by management, as well as the significant spend of consultants. Honourable members, chairs, that brings us then to the third level of assurance, which is where we all get involved. And this includes then the oversight, the portfolio committees, the various councils, various mechanisms that have been put into place, public accounts committees, and ourselves as the external audit. And the reason why we are trying to show this picture, because we're trying to show that we as the Office of Auditor General play a part in a much wider assurance network that needs to function in an effective manner in order to create the required level of assurance. My colleague has already been through what it is that we are asking of the committee to do, the recommendations that we put forward. It is important, I think, that the committee be armed with the right questions to ask when presented with the use of consultants. And to the end, for those of you who have the detailed report at hand, you may refer to page 108 of the report, or later on when you have the report in front of you. 108 has a table called Key Audit Questions, and this was the basis upon which we performed this audit. So page 108 of the detailed report takes each of those circles that we talked about in the life cycle of the user consultant and asks what are the questions that we ourselves ask in coming up with the conclusions we came with. And we think that these questions would be quite relevant to yourselves and helpful to the committee as it goes through and performs its oversight mandate. Chairperson, on the next page, we're just reflecting again that in order to address the issues that we've highlighted around the use of consultants, in order to obtain the value for money that we as a country require, would require commitment to action by all parties involved, and we are quite pleased that by the time we tabled the report, we had got commitment by all parties involved, responded to our findings positively, engaged thoroughly on them, and have committed, and in some cases taken action as well, as the department has, to address some of the gaps and weaknesses identified. On the next page, Chairperson, we've just highlighted some of the comments. Again, these are not new. They all occur in the report. It's an extract from the report, etc. But it echoes what I said earlier, that all parties involved, from yourselves as a committee chair, we met with you before the report was tabled, the minister, the audit department itself, Treasury, as well as the PSA, have all committed and provided input, which we find very heartening. To sum up, honourable members and chair, we just wanted to end with this slide, that it is important to reflect on what I always talk about. I've been saying this. It's a relationship of national importance. It's a relationship of national. What do I mean? Well, basically, what we acknowledge is that the creation of value for our citizens can only be achieved or enhanced when this equation is balanced, when this equation works, that the public sector and the private sector work together properly to enhance the value that the citizen gets out of the state at the end of the day. Now, the subject of our report and the subject of most of the work, in fact, not all the work the Auditor General does, is the public sector, the left-hand side of that equation. And we just want to highlight as well that the second block, the private sector, is an equally important part of that equation, that it is critical to the success of the equation. So as we firm up the left block, the right block also needs to come to the party in terms of correcting some of the practices that it has been accustomed to display. 5 or 10 years, it escalated by 200 or 300%. There was a leveling off, or there wasn't a leveling off. I mean, I think it's very useful to go back some period of time and isolate the development of this problem, because it has been around for a while, but it hasn't been around here forever. And then, armed with that particular analytical approach as to whether or not this thing is climbing steadily, or whether there are bursts, or whatever the pattern is in terms of this ever-increasing amount of expenditure, to try and not just suggest some solutions, which I think is very useful and extremely helpful to us, but also perhaps to analyze what the root causes were beyond what has to be quite a job, I would imagine, that's been produced here, because the AG has got to be above politics. They have sometimes, I think, quite a difficult role to come across as neutral as possible, and one often gets the impression one would love to actually get them in a quiet moment when there's no media present and ask them what's actually going on here, so you might get a different answer. But I mean, I say that lightly. I'm not implying that they have any way ducked the issues, but I would like to get something a little bit beyond the figures and something a little bit more pithy about what they think some of the underlying causes are, other than what they've actually said, because I don't think it tells the whole story. So it's a two-part question, Chair, and I know it does require some research, but perhaps if they do have the figures available, it would be helpful to have them now, otherwise perhaps on a subsequent occasion.
Thank you. Any honourable? Yeah.
Chair, thank you very much. Mine is just one simple question. And key challenges across departments. It's also about youth consulting. I think some of the challenges are the challenges that you are creating for yourself. Under internal capacities, you say consultants appointed due to lack of internal staff capacity. Yes, but my problem is, if you don't have the capacity and you decide to go and get the consultant, isn't that expensive? Aren't you paying more than the staff? Why can't you just get lay people to help you, instead of going still wasting money getting people who are going to cost you more than the ordinary staff? I don't know if you understand me, Jabez. Thank you.
Can I paraphrase?
Yes.
What I hear you asking is that is it not more expensive to use consultants than to build your own internal capacity? Honorable Boy.
I feel I want to answer that last question, but I won't. The question I have is about this e-notice contract, and I'm quite concerned that a half a million
want engineers and everybody else. But unfortunately, this department is a department that must deal with almost with those kinds of things, or engineers and so on. And as such, I am not sure whether maybe through the Department of Transport, Innovation, Education, can we have a comprehensive strategy to deal with the backlog, especially with our education system, in particular the curriculum, so that the end product of what we want to have, we reduce this matter of shortage of skills dramatically. Otherwise, if we deal with it in a piecemeal, will not overcome the burden of shortage of skills. Secondly, the issue of transference of skills by those that are skilled, especially now in terms of consultants. I doubt very much if I'm a consultant and I'm relying on this, you take me to do a particular project in a department, I will work myself out because I'm transferring my skills to this person that we have in the department. It's a vicious cycle. Surely those that are skilled will never transfer to work with yourself out of business, because it's part of my living. That's what we're saying to consultants. Hence the strategy of saying let us re-engineer our education system so that it produces what we want to have as a country. The other thing, Chairperson, I just wanted to check on the 8 departments. Did the AG choose themselves the 8, or was it by departmental choice to say, look, who wants to be chaired by AG? Because the gravity of funds that has been spent and wasted here is too much. It's as if something has gone amiss. Hence, transport is part of this helicopter review, because there are 35 departments and with only 2 aides. Maybe they are, because of the gravity of how they spend monies and so on. That's why transport is part of that. I want to check whether was it a voluntary approach by the department itself to say, look, HEP is what we want to be part of that, or is it out of nature and how the money is spent. This issue of accountability by the committee, I think I'm a bit covered, because I would have asked the AG, what tools are you giving to the committee to empower it so that it asks the relevant questions. And maybe that page that we are referring to, the page 108 from that document, unfortunately, I'm not sure whether members do have. We do have, so that we go through, we have a thorough going it, so that we ask the right questions for the right people. Because at the face value, if you look at these monies that are spent here, are too astronomical. And my colleague is at Management, also Chairperson. See, this report is a previous financial report. It's not the current report. And the projection might be as if it is now. See, the papers might run this issue as if it is running now, currently. And yet it's water under the bridge. That's why we say, how do we rectify, what lessons have we learned so as to correct the measures going forward? I'm not sure the nature of the reporting always comes a little bit too late for us to go into this direction. Now, politically speaking, for me, I'll say, hey, the timing of this is not opportune, because we're going to a particular direction next chapter, so you would understand what I mean, member. Equally, all political parties might say, let's run, here is something, because they've wasted money. And really, that's the nature of it. That's why I'm also interested to hear, get a little bit of more facts, the positive factors that cause the department not to finish on time. Because through the quarterly reports, half-yearly reports, surely the red line should have told the department so that it puts systems in place to overcome this matter. Because it seems to me consultants are not unto themselves of how to spend and how to work at their leisure time, because there are no monetary mechanisms. So I'm saying, Chairperson, I might have missed the point, but I'm really wanting to also myself, especially when you speak figures. I might at the opportune time, I would want to engage the department to tell us, to take us through finger by finger. And maybe also we have a holistic approach on the consultants. Who are these consultants? Well, this, I'm sure, is just part of many consultants. If, as you reported, Chairperson, Northwest, how many? 101 consultants? 110. Only one department, 110 consultants. In fact, it is said they are part of the organogram or the structure. Trade elements. So what does that mean? It seems to me the treasurer, or we don't have systems in place to curb this money. It has been happening under our noses. Nothing happened. So I'm saying maybe we need a full scale of these consultants, and also when we do oversight over them, if we identify those, they should be part of the department, so that also we clear them. I don't think it should just be the DG, his or her staff here. It should also be part of those that we've identified as the committee to come here and explain to the nation why they behave like this, because unfortunately, we'll be crying at the wrong funeral for the DG to explain, and yet the DG is running the bigger department, but this one is just but one. I'm saying that we need to call those consultants to explain to us so that they understand how money public funds are spent. That's my proposal, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honorable Bell.
Thank you, Chair. when on the issue on the issue of consultants perhaps exploiting the situation with our government in as far as weaknesses that they have seen in the system, I don't think just an engagement with people in the corporate world like the AG have said can actually assist the process. You know, I'm trying to think that it would definitely need a high level of patriotism for people in the corporate world to just accept that, okay, we're going to ignore these weaknesses and we'll be good people and do proper business with government without exploiting and making our government bleed. Really to need high level of patriotism. But indeed, it said, Chairperson, that on the issue of tax recapitalization, that, for example, scrap metal proceeds could not be accounted for. Because thinking on this matter deeply, there can be a possibility eventually, if the process is still open like this, for one combi, for example, to be scrapped twice, it's possible. Because I know, for example, of exigencies, and I remember in one committee meeting, I asked a question to the department on what systems that are they putting in place to make sure that a combi that comes in to be scrapped is a combi that has been on the road and doing work. It's not some combi from the scrapyard. And I remember the department committing itself that they've got systems to make sure. And I know that it's not a true reflection, because when we engage with the taxi industry, there are some of the people who have actually got taxi scraps from the scrapyard, work on that body on the scrap, make sure that at the end of the day they've got papers for that particular scrap. And they will tell you that they will pull that scrap wherever it has to be scrapped. And when they're not far from the place, they start the whole thing. Because they would say to you, because what is needed is just to have the combi being driven in. So when you are closer, you take off the ropes, you drive it in. As soon as it has entered the gate, it's taken as a proper combi. And you know that you have actually assembled this thing for about 5,000 rand or so, and are driving off the stage. One another question that I would want to raise to the AG. Since that there's about 8 departments that you audited, my question would be, in terms of the challenges that you have realized in your auditing, would you propose the same panacea as a remedy to the challenges or impediments of all departments that you have audited. Thank you, Chair.
May I then give the team to respond?
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I ask the Honourable Member just to repeat the last question and give the last bit of it.
I'm saying you said that you have audited about 8 departments. So my question is actually to say, are the challenges the same? And can you actually recommend the same panacea as a remedy to all departments that you have audited?
Person, with your permission, respond. My apologies to the committee members who have asked questions. I don't cover them in detail. We'll try to record as many as we could, and I'll do my best to provide clarity on some of it. On the question of the information at our disposal as an office in terms of the historical spend on consultants as a country and as a department over the years, we recognize as well that this is not a new problem, hence us having done these audits in previous financial years. And do we see the historical trends growing? In terms of the information that we have at our disposal, we do definitely see it growing. Whether we have done a complete historical scientific analysis on every year for the last 20, 30 years, no, we haven't. However, when we've done audits in 96 and 2002 and now, we can definitely see an increasing trend. So to answer the question, yes, there is an increasing trend. As to what the underlying causes for that trend are, we haven't done work around specifically pinning down why that is increasing, and at the moment anything we do contribute on that matter would be merely speculation. But the interesting thing is that the use of consultants, growing proportion of the use of consultants is not something that is unique to us in South Africa. It's a problem which we find even in developed economies. For example, our colleagues in the UK, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, depending on what you call it, in the National Audit Office there, did a similar piece of work around the use of consultants in the UK. And what is interesting, to answer some of the other questions as well, was that their findings around how government is extracting the value from consultants are not too far from our own. So even in a country which is supposedly miles ahead of us in terms of its development and its robustness of its processes, are still experiencing the same challenges we are in terms of planning, capacity, etc. And in fact, the growing reliance on consultants as part of government is something that they identified as well. Now getting back to our situation, obviously being an audit, So there are elements of both, and I think what we're saying is that the important thing is to plan properly, to analyze, to look at the services we're getting and to plan for it and say, well, is this genuinely a situation where if I got the person myself, I could do it in a more cost-effective manner, more economical manner? Or is it going to be more economical to get a consultant because the cost of doing this myself is going to be more than the cost of getting it from somebody else who's already invested in all that research, the development. Many of these consultants have a global presence, so they perform the research and development at a global level, and then they spread the costs out across many different countries, and so their economies of scale are a lot better than our governments, etc. So it really does depend. I think the key message from us here is, before you use, sit down and think, what is the most cost-effective option? And do the proper planning up front to say, am I doing the right thing in terms of the cost? Can I get it in a more economical way? Can I get better quality? Can I get it in shorter time, in the right time, et cetera, in a different way? And it's those considerations, I think, that are important. In terms of the vicious cycle, in terms of the transfer of skills, most definitely, it's an area where we can really get into trouble if we don't properly put in place the mechanisms to deal with consultants properly. Consultants, yes, I will, in some cases, will, the behavior we've seen, will not want to transfer voluntarily, as has been said by the honorable member. However, most of them do put it into their contracts. So when they propose, they often propose with a caveat or a proposal that, you know what, if you give us this work, we will make sure we train your people, we will make sure we transfer skills, knowledge, experience to you as a department. However, where do consultants then get away with not doing this? Often, again, it's weaknesses in our own systems, because as I said, we don't have the bodies for them to transfer knowledge to. So the consultant in the contract says, I will transfer knowledge, but there was nobody to transfer that knowledge to. So having vacancies filled, for example, monitoring to make sure that they're doing it. Again, I said the responsibility lies with us as the client to make sure that we are getting the value that we should be getting out of this. And then when we close the project, reflecting again, were the deliverables of value? Did they transfer the knowledge? Have we got the value we were supposed to get out of this project? With respect to the question of how we chose the aid, whether it was voluntarily done or not, this was an independent selection on our part. It was part of our sampling procedure. We were guided by many factors. Predominantly amongst them was the quantum, the amount of money being spent. We were also guided by our other audits, the regularity audit work that we do on a regular basis, that pointed to problems in certain areas. So to cut a long answer short, it was an independent selection by us as an office and not a voluntarily. We were not guided by any departments as to which one to choose and which one not to choose. With respect to the question of what tools we're giving to the portfolio committee, as was correctly pointed out by the honorable member, we think that the report firstly represents an exceptionally valuable tool in terms of bringing to the attention some of these issues. We as an office remain at your disposal to answer questions, to provide input and clarity at these sessions. And the table that I referred to, as well as was mentioned by the honorable member on page 108, we think will provide a very good guide for you in terms of as you go through the process. The next time you see a consulting contract, what question should I ask? And that table will provide you with some of those questions, and I'm sure there will be many more that you yourselves will have done. The report, the detailed report, for those who don't have it, can be circulated if you require it. Please do let us know if you need it. It is available on our website as well, in PDF version as well, for download, but we're more than happy to make that available to the committee as well. With respect to the comment or the question slash comment on the nature of our reporting, that it does come a bit too late, well, yes, you know, that's the nature of an audit. An audit such as this is historically facing, it covered a period that, as was correctly said by the member, can be referred to as water under the bridge. And the stress that we have put on here is to say, well, these things have happened. Let's learn from the mistakes. In terms of catching these things earlier, that's one of the reasons why we took great lengths to officers themselves should be in a position to catch these things first, even before it comes to this committee. You know, the oversight that exists within the department itself, in terms of its own risk structures, in terms of its own oversight structures, should be catching these things well before they come to us. In fact, you'll notice that the Office of the Auditor General on that combined assurance model appears only on the third column, which reflects our role to provide an independent, objective view on whether assurance is working. With respect to the question on what causes the department not to finish on time, there are various reasons for that. And again, you know, we must reiterate our call to firm up the robustness of the planning process, because planning is at the heart of a lot of these things. If we don't plan, and if we don't appropriately consider our timelines up front, chances are our timelines will not be realistic for the achievement of the project. And hence you get overruns, naturally. If you haven't thought about a project up front and you don't up front realize it's going to take you 4 years, but you plan based on a two-year cycle, naturally you're going to end up with an extension period, which is unplanned for. Jacques, I'm going to ask you to perhaps give us a bit more information on the in-artist one. But the comments by the Honourable Member on the taxi recapitalisation issue are noted as well, the issue of whether taxis can be scrapped twice. In the absence of proper records and clarity around the accounting for what happened with this money, many questions arise. Are scrap taxis driving around on our roads? You know, in the absence of proper records and accountability, it becomes difficult to answer those questions. So, in terms of the question relating to the department's challenges and would we propose, what are the challenges they're facing? Are the challenges the same and the recommendations? Again, we must say we've seen with slight variation here and there, subtle nuances in the contracts, yes. But by and large, you know, you'll see that the picture that is emerging is one that points to similar issues being encountered by all departments. Some departments have done better than others, and there's a table in the detailed report which summarizes each of the departments in terms of where the specific issues were found. By and large, planning an appointment remains consistently the biggest issue. Out of the 124 contracts that we audited as part of the national audit, 86 of them were found to have problems with planning an appointment. The second largest area after that was performance management and monitoring of consultants. And so one can clearly see the picture emerging in terms of what are the areas that we as a country need to focus on to correct this, not just within the department and within the portfolio committee here, but at large. I'm just going to ask my colleague Jacques if you can perhaps shed a bit more light for us on the in-artist contract in respect of the 1 billion extra, some of the reasons for that to explain.
Thank you, Naeem. Thank you, Jay, honorable member. With regard to the in-artist contract, the contract was originally awarded for the development of in-artist. So in that time, to the end, in May 2007,
demand is going up. What we do from the external audit, we look at the whole universe of contracts, whether it's consultants or other service providers. And what we often pick up is non-compliance with procurement policy, whether you talk of deviations or extension of contracts. So I felt let me raise this chair so that when the committee looks at the entire problem, it shouldn't be only focused on consultants, but the whole supply chain management. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just a clarity seeking on page 13. It says project was not properly planned by the department and resulted in an increased budget of 2.1 billion. And again, poor planning resulted in 3 extensions over 21 months costing 98 million. So my clarity seeking or question, I don't know, is the department does not involve consultants at an early planning stage. Why now we have a poor planning and also the project is not properly planned if the consultants were there? Thank you.
If I can just follow up on my question, the Auditor General's investigation into that ENATIS overrun spending, whatever, is that contained in the detailed report that you referred to? And if it is, can I please get a copy? And if it's not, can you provide perhaps a summary of the findings for that ENATIS report? Because it's the biggest problem in this whole pack, and I'd like to see the detail of that problem. It's massive.
I also have a follow-up question related to ENATIS. First of all, I want to have a common level of understanding of the value that government wanted to achieve through the benefits of finances. What is it that informed that project? What is it that was going to be gained by having enacted or a system of that nature in place? That is the first issue. I would want this committee to be made clear as to why this particular system in the first place or project. What is it that we wanted to address as a problem, and what is it that we wanted to benefit as a value out of this project, which is then going to move us to a situation where we are able to say from the inception of the project to where we are, we have gained what was supposed to be gained through the project. That is before we even talk of the cost. The cost is an additional issue. The first issue is why did we give birth to this particular project? And have we received what we wanted to receive out of it?
period and this period, if what we were also buying from this company was the skills transfer, who was going to understudy those skills, and how were those skills were going to be transferred to the department, which in my view would result with a declining involvement of the personnel from the consulting company and an increasing involvement of the personnel from the department. But when the contract involves the skills transfer, you first identify the type of skills that are required to be transferred, and then you identify the people within the department that are going to acquire those skills. So the people who are going to be understudied from the ones that are going to be transferring skills, that should form part of the contract. And then you would then agree on the time frame as to how long does it take to transfer this type of a skill, and when will then be the person that is representing the company will be withdrawn because the skill has been adequately transferred and acquired by the person who was supposed to understand it, which would then result with decreasing costs instead of escalating costs. That then is linked to the question asked about the increasing costs. If you are buying a product that comes with the skill transfer, then the milestone when you are dealing with your project management, your Gantt chart, has to indicate that after such a period, so many people will be pulled out from the consultant because within the department they would then the people that have acquired the skills and are able to run with them. That is in relation to Inajim. I am still having more questions to ask in relation to the. I'm just giving you an opportunity to respond to this because the follow-up questions were related to this. I will come back again with another question.
value that we want to achieve by embarking on this project in the first place. Have we got the benefit?
Chairperson, thank you. Honourable members, Honourable Deputy Minister, I would like to appreciate the presentation made by the Auditor General. And we all know that the whole usage of consultants is not a new concept. We have had quite a number of criticisms with regard to vacancies in the department, the lack of skills development, in particular the usage of consultants and the expenses. Although it is also recognized that we need to engage our external private sector, we do not have all the skills in the department, not only our department but in general. For us it is also critical to ensure that the costs involved will adhere to what is in our also our barter pairing principles of value for money. So for us we would like to also not adhere only from an audit perspective, but also a strategic positioning perspective, that we could ensure a proper service delivery from our department's national mandate. But Chairperson, just to remark in principle, we have a proper presentation on all the different audit findings, on the general points, but also on the very specific particular individual contracts which have been audited. And although we are talking about a performance audit, it was quite clear from the investigations done and the actual reality that came forth that there were quite a number of wasteful expenditure matters and irregularities found as a result of this particular audit. So the department welcomed the audit. And in our personal discussions with the role players, we have executed some very immediate remedial processes, and that will be explained in the presentation. However, I would like to focus maybe on the three most important issues that we have identified as a department, without limiting the existence and also the importance of the other. Firstly, planning in the process. We had a reference to the needs assessment as being very important to the whole process of managing the consultants. But the planning process would even have to start before that. It will have to follow after the needs assessment. And following with the planning, we will go into the monitoring, which is the second most important facet that we would like to emphasize. The third one, as we've debated quite intensely here, is a matter of skills transfer. But if we go a little bit back and we look at the planning and we look at the monitoring, we would see that even the reason, and one of our members referred to what was basically called the root causes of these challenges, we will see that it is also a lack of skills existing in the planning component, existing in the monitoring component, that will lead to a poor management of the consultants at the department. Chairperson, but I would like to provide the opportunity with the permission of the committee to our Chief Financial Officer, which is here and prepared to do the presentation, and just remarking our vigilant striving to really adhere to these challenges. Thank you.
Before we allow the Chief Financial Officer to make the presentation, I'm looking at the time. We are now 10 to 1. And in terms of our program, it's supposed to break here by half past 12. remember, Honorable Mbele cited the issue of non-patriotism on the private sector side. To be not ashamed to charge amounts that exceed the value if they are not part of the country. And another member, it can be traced back to the education system of this country, where the majority of the people of this country were denied math and science, which is key to development. I am also having my own daughter. I was thinking, as you were presenting, that Dr. H.F.L. Booth is happy wherever he is. When he's listening to us discussing this today. Because in my view, it has more to do with the education system of this country. That was designed to actually skill the minority groups of this country. If 87% of the population was denied the skill, the kind of education that would produce the kind of skills that we need in this country, we must then have every reason to play that. But we can also not just look at that and say that we are giving ourselves an excuse. Servote is no longer running this country. This country is now governed by other people, and I think it is a responsibility of those that are running the country today to confront the situation. Which then brings me to the question of to the department. The issue of lack of internal capacity as a result of the skill has long been identified. The fact that in the State of the Nation address of the former President, President Begin of 2001, he mentioned the issue of the need for this country to build the kind of skills that are required to build the economy. It's one indicator that that problem was not. The question then that we need to ask is, how did the Department of Transport respond to that? When analyzing that State of the Nation address, how did the Department of Transport respond to that? Then in the response that was given by the Office of the Auditor General, there was an issue about government would not be able to do or to produce or to have the skills in a cost-effective manner, so something like that. And I was saying to myself, I even shook my head when you were responding to that, because I don't agree with you. Government is a number of departments and a number of institutions. It's not the Department of Transport alone. Only requires thinking out of the box and moving away from working in silos. So government is the most resourced institute in the country. make an example of United. To have a team that has got adequate skills to monitor and manage that project could have solved skilled engineers from the university or retired engineers in this country who worked for the government, bring them back as retired engineers to perform just that particular role of monitoring the consultants and make sure that they are doing what they are expected of doing. It was just going to be either a contract of a 2-year contract or a 3-year contract, but you know that you are well capacitated internally to monitor the consultant. And that skill would have been cheaper because it is a pensioner or it is a professor who is lecturing in one of the universities, but who has the responsibility of being part of the project management team that is established by the, put together by the department. So the issue of capacity, yes, lack of capacity in the department, but there's no lack of capacity in the country. There are retired engineers. There are engineers that will be sitting in other companies. There are engineers that will be sitting in universities. It's just the failure of thinking out of the box in the part of the department. The second one, it could have been possible out of the bilateral agreement to get engineers seconded by other countries to come and work on this project. Like it is happening with between South Africa and Cuba in terms of the doctors. It could have also happened on this case in terms of the bilateral agreement with countries that are highly competent in terms of engineers. We could have got those people to be seconded to the department over some period of time and then get the skills and the capacity that we did not have. We could have also done that through an exchange program as a department to say we are developing an exchange program between South Africa and this particular country. We will be taking our own officials to go and learn over a period of time, and we will also take their own people to come and impart skills in our department over a period of time. And then that is a much cost-effective way of getting the skills and building your own internal capacity because that comes through grant funding. I am a product of that. When I was trained in community development, that training was not offered in the formal training here in South Africa. I got that through non-formal education. But then I was sent to developed countries. I went to St. Francis Xavier University in Canada and acquired the best skills in community development through an exchange program. I never paid a cent for that. It was a funded kind of education. And there are countries that have offered that to South Africa. It's just that the Department of Transport doesn't want to get out of the box and use those opportunities. So I am then saying, we just have to be creative and say, is it true that the skills that are required by the Department of Transport for it to use lesser consultants and have less dependence on consultants are the skills that are not available in South Africa and in the African continent and in an international level in the countries that we have bilateral agreements with. And the answer that I'm giving is no. No, a very big no. What is lacking is creativity. And coupled with proper planning to understand what you want to achieve and how you are going to be achieving that. The third issue that I want to make here is related to the very last slide. The very last slide before the thank you slide. Where it says what it takes to tango, the private sector also needs to come to the party. Again, when we are tracing the trend, I think that we have to be very realistic. The tender system has created a problem in the country. Many of the people that are sitting in the private sector are former public sector employees who find it more attractive to go and work in the private sector as consultants as opposed to remaining in the public sector. That is also coupled with lack of patriotism that Honorable Mbele talked about. It is not only money that will build us as individuals and also us as members of the community and build this country. It is not only money. It is the love of the country to choose between making more money and building a country that in which all of us would be happy. So I agree with the issue of saying the private sector also needs to come to the party, because we are also observing new trends of showing off how we have arrived by those that are in the private sector. Who would choose to spend more money on birthday parties than donate that money to build the mad school? Lack of patriotism. So I think that this presentation, we want to thank the Office of the Auditor General, and we want to further engage. As Honorable Suga has said, that there will also be a need for us to engage with the private sector. I also think that there is a need for us to engage with the different spheres of government, the Department of Transport, the different spheres, so that we can arrive at a common level of understanding. But also I think that there is a need to raise the awareness out there that a developed country is more important than a few rich people in the country. A developed country where everybody can enjoy and live comfortable is much better than a country with a few 50 rich people and the rest is poor. That is what will change this trend of over-reliance on consultants and also consultants that do not see themselves as part of the society of South Africa and part of the building block for building a developmental state. I just want us to